WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Zach Cruzy from Michigan State on the topic of comic book creator Steve Ditko. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Whenever I want to know more about a certain topic, I can often go back to the same expert. In the world of politics, that usually starts with an email to Andy Downs. Local history? Tom Castaldi. Unions? Samantha Horton. For the subject of comics, I'm once again turning to Zach Cruzy. Thank you for being here.
Hey, glad to be here, man.
This is the third time you and I have spoken in my 3 years at WBOI. We've talked about Appleseed and Summit City Comic Con. We've talked about Stan Lee. And today we're going to go in depth speaking about a creator who is even closer to your heart in Steve Ditko. When we spoke about Lee, we discussed how comic books came into your life. Now I want to, I guess, bridge the gap a little bit. Can you describe the journey from comic books the hobby to comic books paying the bills and comic books the way of life?
I guess the short version of this is that I really stumbled into comic books as an occupation by accident. So my brother and I went to DCBS in Fort Wayne, and when they had just opened their brick and mortar store and they were closed, and Cameron, the store owner, was there working late at night because that's just what his hours were. And my brother and I, for whatever reason, were like I was in my early 20s, he was in his late teens. And somehow, for whatever reason, we got it into our head that we should draw handlebar mustaches on our face and black out our teeth. It was something he wanted to do, and I agreed to it. And then we decided to stop at a closed comic book shop and sort of peer in the windows. And Cameron noticed us and came over and let us in so we could buy some stuff. And then while I'm standing there checking out with this ridiculous mustache and these sharpied out teeth, Cam says, "Are you looking for a job at all?" And I said, "Sure." And that was that. But I started working there right away and eventually became, in pretty short order, started working in customer service and then became the marketing director there because of all of the connections I had with the comics podcasting community and that sort of thing. So while I was there and making and strengthening those connections that I had in the comics industry with working professionals and artists that would eventually become significant professionals, I started doing my own creative work and had a webcomic for a while. Cameron and I produced a very short-lived series. And from that sort of network of friends in that community is where Appleseed and Summit City came from. So I had been doing this stuff for a long time, very long time. And it all just sort of pieces just kept falling into place. It got to a point where I had an education degree, and I was looking to go back to that. So I ended up back teaching again and working on my graduate degree. And I knew that if I was going to go back to school and pursue my graduate degree, that I was going to have to do it my way. And if it was my way, then I was going to have to do the things that I love the most, which are comics, literature, movies, television, that sort of thing. And I found a degree program in Michigan State that was going to allow me to do things my way, which is really important to me. And then they checked a few other significant boxes for me as well. But that was the biggest one. It's like, can I come here and do my project my way? And they said yes, and they were enthusiastic about it. So here I am. I've completed my degree program. I'll get my PhD, and I'll get the piece of paper in May, even though I've been done for 2 years. I'll get the piece of paper this coming May, and my book will come out, and I'll be teaching somewhere else, and that's the journey.
You were one of several creatives from Northeast Indiana I reached out to when I was putting together that remembrance for Stan Lee, and you just alluded to your book, because last time we talked, you mentioned that you were working on it. It sounds like it's been a productive year in the time since we last talked. Care to tell our listeners more about your book that they can look for in 2020?
Yeah, so it's called Mysterious Travelers, Steve Ditko in the Search for a New Liberal Identity. It is in press. It's in production right now. It'll hit stores in the fall of 2020 from the University of Mississippi Press, and it'll be available everywhere. Comic shops can order it, but it also be available, you know, at all the usual locations. This has been a long time coming. I've been working on this project off and on for, you know, more or less since I came to DCBS and really started writing comics. I knew that I wanted to write something historical and interpretive about Steve Ditko's work. It is a critical examination and sort of recontextualization of his work, of the comics he produced between 1953 and 1986. He produced up until the day he died in 2018, but I'm stopping at 1986 specifically because of the ramifications of his work on important comics like Watchmen, right? And Watchmen comes out in 1986. So that was just sort of the temporal marker for me. And what's so interesting about Ditko's work is that it was always philosophically driven. In some cases, in many cases, that philosophy or that philosophic perspective that he had or was, I guess, developing is probably a better way to say it, began with his earliest comics in the 1950s, but really sort of galvanized into something identifiable in the early 1960s and then in the early 1970s, like in that sort of period. There's about a 10-year period between 1962 and 1972 where things have really just come into sharp focus. He's certainly reflective of a general sort of shift in the American political consciousness that is stepping away from the, let's say, values or ideals or ideological principles, however you want to frame it, that were popular with the New Deal and even with the social programs of the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s and so on, sort of stepping away from that and into a more liberal model. And by liberal, I don't mean Democrats, the left. I mean liberal as in liberalism as it was initially conceived, liberalism in the context of, say, neoliberalism. So Ditko's a part of that conversation and reflects it for a popular audience. So anyway, so that's more or less what the book's about. And there's just a lot of really interesting, strange entanglements there that he makes available to readers.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Zach Cruzy. And this episode is Comic Books, Lesson 1. There's a lot of unsung heroes in the world of comic book creators. Speaking as a Batman fan, the average person has maybe heard of Bob Kane, but maybe not Bill Finger. Does that comparison fit well with Stan Lee and Steve Ditko?
Yeah, in some rather significant ways it does, at least as it pertains to credit. But there are some pretty substantial differences between them as well. People have heard of both Finger and Steve Ditko, right? I mean, in comic circles, people know who that is. And there's a Bill Finger documentary, and there's an award named after Bill Finger. And even though Kane is far more well-known than Bill Finger, he never had the kind of cultural cachet that Stan Lee created. So that's a pretty significant difference there as well. And also, one of the other things that we have talked about sort of leading up to this is that, you know, I don't know that the Finger comparison is super great, even though there's some overlap, because Bob Kane did draw Batman. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but I mean, ultimately, he is responsible at some level for the lines that were on the page. So it's not so clear, though, about how much, say, that Stan Lee wrote of The Amazing Spider-Man or Doctor Strange. In fact, it's really murky about whether or not he wrote much of anything other than sort of throwing names and very broad plot ideas at Steve Ditko. So, for example, in The Amazing Spider-Man, Lee wanted Spider-Man to deal with space aliens and would tell Ditko, let's do an alien story, a story that Ditko hated, by the way. And then Steve would go back and then plot and effectively write the story, illustrate it, bring it back, and then Lee goes in and edits the dialogue based on Ditko's script that he provides with it. Same thing with Doctor Strange, right? Lee might say, I want Loki to be in this issue. Ditko would roll his eyes and then write an issue with Loki in it. Or I want a haunted house in this issue. Same thing. I think you can make a case that the finger cane relationship is a little bit more symbiotic than that, right? Insofar as both are actually producing something, you know, fairly substantial, even though Bob Kane, what he did was what he did to Bill Finger through a sort of contractual finagling was unconscionable to a lot of later comics fans and some historians. Anybody who's really worked in the industry, certainly in those early days, has these kinds of war stories about not getting their due credits.
You have an extraordinary knowledge of comic books and their creators. So with that entire pantheon available to you, what drew you to Steve Ditko?
So at first, it was the art. I first found Ditko when I was fourth or fifth grade. Marvel was putting out these. What they did is they reprinted first issues and significant stories in the history of their sort of most important characters, like the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, and so on. I picked up the Ditko Spider-Man stories, and it was just, the art was just so strange and so alien, and the way that Spider-Man moved and gestured and the fear and the emotion and the way that the characters emoted, all of these things created these really distinct affective moments on the page, regardless of whatever the dialogue said or didn't say. The art really carried the story. And that was a big revelation for me in terms of like the way that I thought about and read comics. But I started paying less attention to writers and much more attention to the art and how the artist was really telling the story. I credit that to Ditko in a pretty big way. And then later on, as I read more and more of his stuff or read it over and over again, then the philosophic stuff really came to the fore. And like I said earlier, I mean, so much of that is delivered through the art. And it's not that I ultimately ended up agreeing with him, but that there was a philosophic exploration that I could sort of suss out as, you know, a middle schooler or high schooler, or, you know, like that I can see these things happening on the page was huge for me, and really opened up the possibilities of what I thought comics could be and what they were, you know, in the decades before something that is distinctly philosophical and distinctly, politically motivated, like, you know, like the comics of Alan Moore. So yeah, that was a huge, huge revelation for me finding his stuff.
We've already referenced him several times in this conversation. I think most comic book fans know Steve Ditko because of his work with Spider-Man. But who are some of his creations that the general public might not realize go back to Ditko?
He has a big catalog, a surprisingly big catalog. It's not as many characters as, say, Jack Kirby, but it's substantial and important in numbers. So Doctor Strange is solely Steve Ditko's creation. Lee came to that well after the fact and had nothing to do with the first two stories. Captain Atom, which is the character who is the basis for Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen, he revamped the Blue Beetle and gave us the Ted Kord version of Blue Beetle, which is the basis of Night Owl in Watchmen. He gave us The Question, who had his own series, but The Question, along with another character called Mr. A, were the basis for Rorschach in Watchmen. Shade the Changing Man, Hawk and Dove, who are on the Titans TV series now, The Creeper, Static, and this is a different Static, not the Milestone character that a lot of people, a lot of like millennials will recognize from Static Shock, the Static Shock cartoon, different Static. But so those are some of the most significant, but there are tons more, and hundreds of horror and weird fantasy and suspense and romance and humor and Western and war comics. I mean, he contributed to every genre and worked steadily for, you know, like I said, from 1953 to 2018 to the day he died. His output is substantial, but some of the things that I think we'll recognize most, at least in a broad sense, are these. Besides Spider-Man and Doctor Strange, it was Steve Ditko who designed Iron Man's red and gold armor. That the armor that we see now, even with its modified version, that's because Steve Ditko came in and fixed it. It was Ditko who came up with the idea to have the Incredible Hulk transform because of his emotional state. So that anyone knows that the Hulk becomes the Hulk, Bruce Banner becomes the Hulk because he's angry, that's thanks to Steve Ditko writing that in. That was his idea. And for comics readers, if you recognize the classic sort of Marvel corner boxes where it would say Marvel and then it would have like character heads or a silhouette or a standing character, that was Steve Ditko's idea, too. I mean, that was a marketing sort of element that he brought to the comics to help make those stand out. And you know, even though it's not a narrative element, it be- became something and still is something that a lot of us have very fond memories of for whatever reason, and becomes sort of a point of interest for us, you know, aesthetically. So he added a lot to the conversation, and he not only added a lot to the conversation through this very direct means, but he added a lot to the conversation because so many people felt as though they had to respond to his work. And that says a lot about his legacy and his import in the way that we read and think about comics and popular media now.
You already mentioned, whether it's through Spider-Man's movements or some elements of comics that relate more to design and marketing, that there's a lot of contributions that Ditko made. But I guess more generally, how did he set himself apart as an artist? You can look at it and you go, oh, that's Ditko's work.
His layouts, even though many of them are fairly standard, became sort of a touchstone for a lot of later artists who sort of modeled their work on the way that he would lay out a page and sort of build a narrative and build tension through the layouts. But the way the characters moved in sort of this tangled up, not quite anatomically correct way, but a way that was interesting. Ditko was never interested in anatomical perfection. He thought that that was boring. It was much better to have the art sort of emote in some way to get some kind of message across about the character. And one of the ways that he did that probably most profoundly was with his hand gestures and facial expressions. Ditko had this sort of uncanny knack for creating fear on a page and sort of getting that across to the reader, whether it is close shots of people who are just racked with guilt and like they're tearing and clawing at their faces and pulling their eyes down, or just beads of sweat everywhere just pouring off of them as their face sort of melts into the state of panic. And Ditko has this way of just conveying that that's really convincing and powerful, that is just uncommon amongst his peers. The other thing that he managed to accomplish that not everyone else did was that he was able to use those particular elements, whether it's his page layouts or the way that he staged his figures and the way that like he would block things out. He was able to use those things to create sort of intellectual, philosophic content, to layer his stories. There's always sort of that surface level narrative of what's happening, just the basic plot. But beneath that, behind that, there's something else much more profound that he's sort of toying with. And he's able to do that because he had very early on mastered the ability to create these claustrophobic, terrifying, tension-filled panels and pages. So when you see a 9-panel grid in a comic now, for example, Tom King and Mitch Gerard's recent Mr. Miracle comic, which has won all kinds of awards, employs a 9-panel grid. They're pulling that straight from Ditko. Even if Gerard says that, like, well, I'm pulling it from Watchmen. Well, if he's pulling it from Watchmen, then he's still pulling it from Ditko because Watchmen steals it from Ditko first. Because he sort of lays that foundation for people, he gives them an opportunity to take that foundation, see what he did with it, and then sort of for it to be repurposed across any number of different kinds of narratives for different narrative and intellectual purposes. And I don't think that we should understate that, the value of that contribution.
That value, especially, again, for audiences that both read comics and have seen the movies, I mean, he's contributed so much to comics on the silver screen just in the last decade and some change, whether it's the iconic first shots of the full, as you mentioned, red and gold Iron Man suit in the first Iron Man film, or Mark Ruffalo's Bruce Banner saying, "I'm always angry," right before he transforms in the Battle of New York, or the inspirations for characters who wound up in Watchmen, which now has another life as an HBO series. I pose this question to you because I know you have the background, the knowledge base to really delve into it well. What do you see as the long-term impact of Ditko's work as this art form continues to just grow and grow?
He's part of two really major shifts in the way that superheroes were conceived and proceeded after that point, for better or worse. The first is because he worked so diligently through his art to identify his characters by their internal states, right? It was always about the character's psychology and their growth or de-evolution as human beings. His comics are almost always about that. Because he was able to convey those things, he allowed for these two sort of big moments to happen. The first one happens in The Amazing Spider-Man number 33. This, for my money as a critic and historian, is the moment in American superhero comics where we change our ideas about what a superhero is. Leading up to this point, superheroes are not always, you know, I never want to paint with too broad a brush, but more often than not, flat characters who cannot and do not experience any substantive amount of emotional, intellectual change over time. They are characters who pop in serial narratives, who show up, beat up a monster, move on. And for example, you and I are not going to be Superman. That's just out of the question. It's not going to happen. We might be able to be Clark Kent someday, but we're never going to be Superman. We're also never going to be Batman because neither of us have the infinite resources or the adamantine will that Batman has to perform the feats that he does, much less go on the magical adventures that he was going on throughout the 1950s and 60s. Spider-Man's different. Spider-Man instead tells the reader that we can be him. The way that that happens in the most impactful sense, that happens because in The Amazing Spider-Man 33, this is a story where Aunt May is very sick, of course. Peter Parker, Spider-Man, is trying to get a serum to save her life. He's got the serum, but it is stolen by Dr. Octopus and his goons. Peter finds this out, chases Dr. Octopus and his goons down to this underwater lair. A battle ensues, and because Peter is so overcome with rage and emotion, he accidentally pulls the building down on top of him. And after he's pulled the building down on top of him, he is trapped. And in the opening five pages of Amazing Spider-Man 33, we immediately come to Peter Parker trapped under all of this rubble, and he's trying to fight his way out. He has to build himself up to this. And over a course of five pages, he does just that. And when you read those pages, it's just incredible. The emotional ups and downs and all of these things that allow Peter to escape. But what it boils down to, and you see this coming through all of it, is that what makes Peter Parker, what makes Spider-Man a superhero, is not his superpowers, it's not the web shooters, it's not the gadgets, it's not the costume, it's none of that. It's his heart. It's that he's a human person. It's that he has the intellectual and the emotional strength to carry on. He has the will to do this, to overcome his own failure, to set aside his past, to set aside all of his misgivings and misdeeds and anything he's screwed up on. He can put those things behind him, lift this rubble off of him, literally push the burden off of him, and then run out, get the serum, and save Aunt May. That's an incredible moment. That changes everything about the way that we think and talk about superheroes. Very few, if anyone, I would argue almost no one was talking about superheroes or presenting them in that way before that moment. No one at all. That is not the same thing, not even close to the same thing as Superman showing up and punching a giant gorilla with kryptonite laser beams coming out of its eyes. That is not the same thing as the Joker riding around on a giant chicken and then Batman punching him in the face. That is not the same as Aquaman and Green Lantern switching roles for the day and Aquaman having to drive around a big truck with an aquarium on the back so that he doesn't get too dry. That is not the same thing. Those are goofy, fun stories for children. Spider-Man makes it about your heart, makes it about you personally, the reader. And because of the visual choices that Ditko makes for Spider-Man, because he gives him a costume that covers his entire body, Peter Parker can be anyone. That's huge. There is no race. There is no specific gender identity. There's no ethnic background. None of that stuff exists when Peter Parker puts on that mask, right? Admittedly, when you see Peter Parker, okay, he's a white guy living in Queens. But like when that mask comes on, when he is the superhero, when he is that thing that has to have all of that heart, everything else disappears. That's a huge, huge moment. And that's the one that we grapple with. That's the thing that makes people sort of well up at these movies over and over again. And that's Ditko. He gave that to us. So that's a big deal. On the other hand, the following year, Steve Ditko tells another story with the character of the Question, who decides that, and in that moment decides that this is an opportunity for superheroes to kill people again, or to at least not worry about saving their lives. And the Question does that. He kicks two criminals into the rushing waters of a sewer, and they, as they flow down the sewer, they scream out to him. They say, please save us, do your duty. And the question says, duty to who? Why would I risk my neck for the likes of you and let them die? That's also a big moment. Up until that point, it's not as though superheroes hadn't killed people or that characters hadn't died in comics, but that a superhero makes the specific choice in an era when the comics code told publishers that they should not have those kinds of choices is a big deal and ushers in this whole wave of antiheroes, which Ditko did not approve of, right? That was not his point in giving the question this wherewithal to let these people die. He's trying to push at something a little bit more interesting than that. But because that's the way it was read, if there's a question about that sort of action in characters that kill people with impunity, or the way that Rorschach behaves, or even that characters a few years later, like the Punisher, become heroic, even though they start out as villains, that comes back to this moment with the question where he decides to kill people, which outraged people at the time. So he makes these sort of grand gestures that have caused people and still causes to sort of think through the ethics and morality and the consequence of being a superhero and how we can identify with them and whether or not we really want to identify with them and all sorts of, you know, interesting, complicated things.
Zach Cruzy, thank you so much for joining me today and being a part of the comic book fabric of the Midwest. It's always great to hear from you.
I was so glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team, and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Additional audio comes from John Dawkins. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship and Michaela Veltum. Thank you for listening. From WBOI, Fort Wayne.